All right, welcome back to Jay Flemma Sports Report on iHeartRadio. I am Jay Flemma of the Golf News Net Radio Network and jayflemma.com. We want to say thank you to our last guest, Gary Van Sickle of SI.com and of Morning Read. And now we're going to jump forward in the schedule, but not too far, because it's coming up and coming up fast. The PGA Championship at an old classic and a favorite a lot of the touring pros, Southern Hills in Tulsa, Oklahoma, one of Perry Maxwell's great courses. And here today to talk about Perry Maxwell and Southern Hills and the PGA Championship, we're going to take it all the way out to this great state of Indiana. Please welcome writer, author, and great sports fan, Chris Clouser. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jay. Thanks for having me.
Now, you've written a really well-celebrated book about Perry Maxwell called The Midwest Associate. Tell us a little bit about who Perry Maxwell was.
Yeah, so Perry Maxwell was a guy who grew up in Kentucky, basically wanted to find some place that he could live to get away from what he had as they called consumption back then. It was tuberculosis, and found this place in Southern Oklahoma right before Oklahoma became a state. So it wasn't even a state yet when he moved there, called Ardmore. And it's in the southern part of Oklahoma, just across the border from Texas, and moved there with his new wife and took a job as a banker. And then after about, 10 years in town, was encouraged to start taking up golf by his wife. And they bought a poor farm just north of town that had an immense amount of property, and turned part of it into a dairy farm. And then the other part, because he was getting fascinated with golf, he turned into basically a four-hole golf course on his own property, and was out there, just did it on his own. And then slowly he became more and more interested. His wife encouraged him to actually start building golf courses, try to get him away from other things in his life that were more physically active. He was a huge tennis player and was like a state champion, and it was taking its toll on his body. And so she tried to push him towards golf. And then so he kind of acclimated towards that after building the four-hole course, and decided to research a little bit more, and started a conversation through letters with Charles Blair McDonald, and then eventually met with McDonald at the National Golf Links. And that's kind of where he got his start, by kind of falling under McDonald's tutelage about how to use template holes to create a golf course. And he went back to Ardmore and created the rest of a 9-hole course at that time in 1914 that began the history of Dornick Hills Country Club there in Ardmore, and then kind of took off from there with contracts across the state, and then eventually into a national career where he was a partner with Alistair McKenzie, and took contracts pretty much anywhere from Kansas and Oklahoma and Texas all the way across to North Carolina and up into the Northeast and the Philadelphia, New York region.
Now, about what year did he travel to Oklahoma with his family?
So he moved to Oklahoma, I want to say it's like 1901, 1902. So it was right before they became a state, because he became friends with a guy named Lee Cruse, who became the first governor of the state shortly after that.
Now, that means that you said it was about a 10-year time period. Does that mean around 1911 is when he built the four holes on his estate?
Yeah, it was probably like 1911, 1912, because and then 1914 is when Dornick Hills was actually founded. And that's when they had 9 holes. It was in 1914.
So, now, yeah. What was the economy of Oklahoma like at that point in American history? Was it a rich state, or was it a dust bowl? Was it something in between?
So a lot of it depends on where you're at in Oklahoma. So in Ardmore, it was very affluent. Ardmore had three things going for it. Number one, it was where the railroads met from the east to the west. That you could go from all the way to Ardmore from the East Coast, and then from Ardmore out to California on the West Coast through trains that traveled through Ardmore. And it was also a good stop for a lot of people going to Texas and Dallas for the cattle trades. And then also Oklahoma for a post-Civil War was the cotton capital of the country. So they had a lot of affluency from that. And then in the early 1900s, the oil fields happened just about a half hour away and healed. And that basically drove the economy from then until still does in southern Oklahoma. So based on all that and Maxwell being a banker in Ardmore, it was a very affluent time for Ardmoreites. They actually had more millionaires per capita in Ardmore, Oklahoma than there were in any other place in the country at the time.
Now, let's talk a little bit about Dornick Hills. Two things that I like in particular when I was there, it absolutely was deeply moving to see the grave of Perry Maxwell and his wife. And then there is something there called a wall hole. But for all of you listening out there that are thinking, oh, it must be like the wall behind the 17th at St. Andrews at the old course, or it must be like the wall that runs along insert name of golf course here, a lot of Don Ross courses, for example. But no, the wall at Dornick Hills is much different. So tell us a little bit about Perry Maxwell's grave and tell us a little bit about the wall.
Yeah, so Maxwell's grave is placed on this little outlook that looks out over the seventh fairway. It's part of a family cemetery, for lack of a better term. It has several graves from other family members. One of his daughters is buried up there. His wife is buried there as well. And then some other relatives. So I don't remember the exact number, but there's several graves up there. And a few years ago, they cleared out the trees that were in front of the grave site, so you could actually see from the fairway up to the memorial and then from the memorial down onto the course. And it's on the northern edge of the property that Maxwell owned. So it's a pretty special site. It's where he buried his wife when she died in the early 1900s. And that's where he was buried after he passed away in 1952. So yeah, it's pretty special to be up there and be able to look over his property, as a lot of people still call it. The course itself, yeah, the famous hole is the Cliff Hole, which has like a 40-foot wall of rock, essentially from the base of the fairway where up to the green site that's up at the top of the cliff. And it's a par five. At the time when it was built, it was the longest hole in Oklahoma. It's still a pretty tough hole to reach in two shots, but the college players seem to do it more often than not today. But for the regular Joe, it's a pretty stiff challenge because you got to be able to judge how far away you want to be to try to hit it up to the top of the hill. And you don't want to get too close, because if you get too close, you're going to hit right into the face of the cliff and it'll just bounce right back at you. So it's an interesting hole. I know Tom Doak likes it a lot and really took some time to really take special care of that hole when he was there recently for some restoration work. So it's a really unique part of golf in Oklahoma and it's probably it's the hallmark hole at Dornick Hills.
About how steep is the face? Do you have any idea of the vertical pitch?
So let's see. I would say it's probably like 60 degrees to get up there. You can walk up it. And they have like a place on the far right side where there's like some stairs that are carved into the rock a little bit. And I know like Mike Holder, who used to play there when he was like a high school student, says that he climbed up the face of the cliff to get from the fairway to the green, which there's what you could probably do it, especially if you're a young guy that's nimble, but I wouldn't try it today. But so you could do it. It's just I wouldn't want to try to do it myself. So
now people say that Maxwell's career can generally be divided into three parts: pre-McKenzie, with McKenzie, and post-McKenzie. Do you find that to be true?
I would say three parts is pretty accurate. I don't know about the breakout. I would say the first part would be, I would say that would run like until like 1925, 26. I would say probably the first part you could say is pre-McKinsey. And then McKinsey until World War II, I think is the second part. And then post-World War II is the third part, because that third part specifically, he did almost everything with his son. And his son wasn't involved in anything before that, really, before World War II, except for doing some work on site. But he had like no design input or anything like that. But post-World War II is Perry and his son Press working together on everything. So that's kind of how I would divide it. You can maybe break it into four groups if you wanted to break the McKinsey section apart, but I think that McKinsey through the start of World War II is kind of that second period. And the reason I think that is because if you look at his work after McKinsey, it still has a lot of the same type of flair and style that the McKinsey work has. So it really feels like it's a continuous part of his career from start to finish in that section of time.
It's Jay Flemma Sports Report. We're here with Chris Clouser, a well-respected expert on golf, and in particular, Perry Maxwell, the architect who designed Southern Hills, where they are playing this year's PGA Championship. So, Chris, tell us where Southern Hills falls in the timeline and in the career arc of Maxwell.
Yeah, so Southern Hills was the first big course that Maxwell did post the McKinsey partnership. So it was 1935 when it actually, yeah, the club was established in 1935, 1936 in that range. Maxwell started working there 34, I think, the end of 34. So it's right. It's kind of that middle. It's basically the midpoint of his career post McKinsey, and right before all the Dust Bowl type stuff in Oklahoma really happened. And he had to start going out to Kansas and going down to Texas to get work. And so I would say it's kind of the midpoint of his career. And it's probably also the high point of his career, I think. I mean, it's just, I think Southern Hills, you can talk about other courses, but I think Southern Hills is the course that he really achieved like the pinnacle of what he was wanting to do with the championship caliber course. So
now, I suppose at this point, we should talk a little bit about Maxwell's style pre his working with McKenzie and then after McKenzie joined up with him. How would you say his style changed over time?
Yeah. So, I mean, you got to look at what he did before. So if you think about what his influences were before McKenzie, he studied a lot with Charles Blair McDonald. So he had a lot of template driven kind of stuff in his mind. He did a lot of research in the Southern United States for grass research for, so he could build grass greens in Oklahoma. And in that process, he got to be friends with Donald Ross and studied a lot of Ross courses. So he kind of picked up some routing techniques that Ross used. So if you
such as
routing from a high place through a valley and up to a high place, tee, low valley, fairway, up to a green that's in an elevated location. It's a perfect example. I mean, almost all his great courses start with that. First tee is elevated up and goes out to a green that's kind of somewhat elevated. And he routes a lot between high locations to valleys and back up again. And so the template driven greens and his bunkering, when he used it, because it was very, he was sparing in the amount of bunkering he would put on his courses, especially fairway bunkers. His bunkering wasn't ovals and stuff like that, like some people imagine, like Southern Hills used to be in its heyday. It's really rough cuts into the terrain to get like a very steep wall into the bunker, and it had rough edging, and so it was very feral looking, I guess is a good word. And then those are kind of the hallmarks of what he had. And he had some greens that were really had like the buried elephants and stuff like that. Like Twin Hills had a couple that were famous for having these huge bumps in the green back when he
you
built
mean
that
Twin
course.
Twin Hills in Oklahoma,
yeah.
The second course that he did in his career.
Yeah, the second big course, yeah. And that was in Oklahoma City, and it hosted the 1935 PGA Championship. So if you look at those and then compare them to what happened post McKenzie, you can see his bunkering became a little bit more artistic, had a little bit more of a artist flair to it. Not so rough looking. I mean, it had irregular shaping, but it just wasn't as carved out. It was flowed more into the terrain. And then his green sights probably had a little bit more of a softer bubbling within the interiors, and then a little bit more of like a scalloping look on the outside at times. And then his routing is the one thing I really think changed a lot with McKenzie. Instead of going straight into like hill faces and coming straight down, he started routing horses to go alongside hills, like Southern Hills. The 10th hole runs off of the hill and down, and it kind of comes back up into it. So it works against that grain of the hill.
Sure. Reverse camber.
Yeah. So he used the terrain to kind of tilt the fairways more, as opposed to going straight in and straight away from the hillside.
A little like Olympic Club.
Yeah, probably not to that extreme, because I don't think he had sights that were that tilted from top to bottom. But
yes,
but yeah, same idea. A lot of fairway tilts, and it's something he became synonymous with later in his career, because this place is like Southern Hills, where he used that a lot.
All right. So speaking of Southern Hills, what do you think are going to be the pivotal holes to watch for swings of fortune?
Well, I think the obvious ones are going to be the par fives. Because I think every one of those are probably reachable in two by the pros. So if they can handle the green surfaces with the long shots, they're going to be hitting into them. 13 in particular has got water in front of it that if you're just a little off, you're going to put the ball in the water. I think those three holes, I'm not sure if they're going to use three or two par fives. It depends on what they do with like 16, I think. But those three holes are probably going to be pivotal. I think 9 and 18, just because of the slope in those greens, I wouldn't want to have to go to 18 and have to hit a two putt to win the championship, especially if you happen to get above the hole. I mean, that's going to be almost impossible. So
we remember one of the worst hockey games in U.S. Open history in 2001, when Mark Brooks and Retief Goosen basically, you know, three putted, four putted, all kinds of nightmares, and ended up in a playoff.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think probably the one other hole I would talk about is the 17th, because it's just a short par four. And depending on how they set it up, I mean, it could be a hole that maybe somebody like a Bryson DeChambeau can drive it. Maybe. I don't know. That could be a pivotal hole depending on how it gets set up. I mean, if they're all playing irons and pitching wedges or lob wedges into it, then it's not going to be that big of a difference. But if they set up to where they want people to try to be daring and try to drive it, that could be an interesting hole.
One of the things I noticed that Maxwell likes to do, he did it at Dornick Hills and at Oklahoma City Golf and Country Club and at Southern Hills, is he likes a right angle dog leg, and that awkwardly dog legs in a place that keeps you off balance. For example, Tiger Woods played the 10th hole in 2007, 7-iron, 7-iron. Yep. Very odd, but he played it effectively.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think when you're looking at the way the pros play a course, you got to think about it a little different than the way you or I would play it. I mean, Tiger Woods or somebody else of that level, they're thinking about what's the easiest way for me to attack the hole for a potential birdie. And they want the best shot that they can get to get in there. You or I are thinking, okay, how far down the fairway can we get to have the shortest club in our hand to get it onto the green. So going with that approach. And the other thing that they're thinking about is, okay, where's the flattest lie? Because if I've got a lie where the ball's above my feet or below my feet, I've got to hit a little bit different shot than what I would normally hit into the green. And the way that green runs, you got to account for that as well. So there's a lot of things to think about when you're playing into one of those type of holes that Maxwell would have set up. I mean, a good example is like, at Dornick Hills, you mentioned the fifth hole is kind of like that. And it's either you play out to this plateau and you have a beautiful shot down into the green, which is probably a 9 or an 8 iron for you or I, but a short wedge for those guys, but that it's not going to be a full shot. So they can't get the spin on it they want, or, and they'll go above the hole and they don't want to putt back down that green. So, I mean, that's something that they're always thinking about. Whereas you and I are, we're like, we just want to be on the green in regulation and try to two putt.
Last question before we take a break. You know, you hit the nail on the head with regards to that. One thing that Tiger also did that same PGA Championship was he said he played to where he had a flat putt, preferably uphill, rather than trying to get close. He said that the 8-footers that had huge breaks were much tougher than the 20-footer that didn't break, and that's how he shot that 63. And I found that answer intelligent, and I found he basically hoylake'd the place like he did at the British Open in 2006 at Royal Liverpool with his head. He won that US Open with his head and with his putter. So what are your thoughts on the greens and how much trouble is it going to give these guys?
Well, I think every one of them, well, number one, they just recently went through a restoration that kind of reestablished the contouring of a lot of those greens that wasn't there probably the last time a lot of these guys played in a major championship. If any of these guys were still in the major championship field back then, that was what,
15 years ago.
Yeah. So how many of these guys were actually there then? So, and the question is how familiar are they going to be with the course? Because they probably haven't played it until this year. So getting the contouring on those new greens figured out is going to be a big deal. So I mean,
plus like there's the element of surprise as well, because up until 2 years ago, everyone thought we were going to Bedminster.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know if that really messes with their minds so much. I mean, but I definitely think that they're going to have a different strategy around how to get into a lot of the greens and what are the best angles to come in at, especially on some of the holes that they can really attack. Like 3 is probably a good one. 4 is another one that they can really attack, and just trying to figure out where the best place to put the ball off the tee is, to have the best shot into the green, and then figure out, okay, from the contouring of the green, how do I get there? So they almost have to think about from the green back to the tee and how they're going to set up their hole, how they're going to attack the hole.
You're listening to Jay Flemma Sports Report on iHeartRadio and Golf News Net Radio Network. We will be right back after this. All right, we're back with Jay Flemma Sports Report. Still talking to Chris Clouser, resident expert on all things Perry Maxwell, and also resident expert on all things on Indiana public golf. After all, this is a show for you, the great American sports fan, especially the golfer, and anybody that wants to travel to Indiana. Chris has got you covered. He wrote a book about all the great public Indiana golf courses, and they're all very inexpensive and they're a lot of fun and really good. The book is called A Month of Saturdays. So Chris, welcome back to the show. Tell us a little bit about where are the best places to play golf in Indiana.
Yeah, so in Indiana, I mean, there's a lot of great public golf all around the state. I know this is the month of the race here in Indianapolis, so if you wanted to stay close to Indianapolis, there's a lot of good public golf around the Indianapolis area. I mean, obviously, almost everybody has heard of Brickyard Crossing right down on the speedway. I mean, 4 holes are inside the actual speedway. So if the cars are running, it's kind of a unique experience that you won't get anywhere else. The golf course itself is pretty good. It's got a lot of typical Pete Dye type stuff, but it's got some really good holes too. It's a fun place to play. Also on the northern suburbs, there's Purgatory, which is up in my neck of the woods, Noblesville. It's really, it's got a lot of bunkers, a lot of tough greens, but it's a very fun course to play. If you play it from the right tees, there's a lot of people that get suckered into playing the back tees, and that's where it gets its name because it's so hard from back there because it's so long. Another great place is place called Bear Slide. It's kind of off the beaten track that has a lot of unique holes on the back nine and a couple of really cool ones on the front nine. And then another really great place, and this is probably the best deal in the state of Indiana, it's a place called the Trophy Club. It's in Lebanon, Indiana. It's about 30 miles northwest of Indianapolis that has amazing rates. It's a Tim Liddy design, and it has some of the best hole public golf holes in the state of Indiana, I think. And then if you want to go a little bit to more the resort type stuff and go to like French Lick, to the famous Dye course that's down there, that's got a lot of publicity since it opened. And there's a Donald Ross course there as well. And then just a little few miles away, there's a place called Sultan's Run that is a Tim Liddy design as well. That is excellent. It's got some great par fives on that course. Some of the best, probably the best set of par fives on a public course in the state. And there's places all around the state. There's in the Northwest, there's a couple of great places up by Fort Wayne. South Bend's got a couple of great places, like the Notre Dame course is awesome. Purdue's got two good courses there. And then IU, Indiana University, just reopened their course, and it had a massive redesign. It's a great place to play now. So
who designed those three university courses at Notre Dame, Purdue, and IU?
So the Notre Dame course was Core and Crenshaw. The old course that was there, I don't know who designed it. It's been there a long time, but the new course, the Warren course, is Core and Crenshaw design. The Purdue courses, there was a course there called Ackerman Hills. It got refurbished by Dye not too long ago. And then obviously the big course is the Pete Dye course there that has hosted NCAA championships. And then the Indiana course was just redone. I'm trying to think who did that one. I don't know who did that one off the top of my head, but it was just redone. The original course was built like the guy who was the golf course there, golf coach at IU at the time in the 1950s. So all three of the big universities have really nice golf courses now. And there's a lot of other good places around the state to play. So,
can I ask you to throw a bone to one of my favorites, a place called The Fort?
Oh yeah, completely forgot about that. That one's actually inside Indianapolis. It's on the property of Fort Benjamin Harrison Park, it's a state park, Fort Benjamin Harrison State Park. And The Fort is on that location. It was done by Pete Dye. You kind of get a drift here. There's a lot of Pete Dye and Tim Liddy stuff here because they're just so well liked in the area and have done so many great courses. But the Fort is an excellent course as well. I'll completely space that one. But yeah, I mean, and there's actually a couple of like packages that for stay and play packages here in the area where you can play like almost all those courses in the Indianapolis area. I mentioned the Fort, Purgatory, Prairie View, and Carmel, which is a really good Robert Trent Jones Jr. course. The Trophy Club, I think, used to be part of that. I don't know if it is anymore. And then Brickyard Crossing sometimes is in those. So you can get a good package and play some really good golf courses in Indianapolis. And then there's another one that's fantastic. A Spires design on the south side, too. Not to leave out the south side, but Heartland Crossing is really good, too.
Yeah, and Tim Liddy actually was one of the design associates. He started his career with Pete Dye before he went out on his own.
Yeah, and he worked a lot with Pete towards the end of Pete's career as well. Was a design associate on a lot of the later courses that Pete did in the area, like Bridgewater. And I think they had a new place that opened just a couple years ago, right before Pete passed away. So,
yeah, everybody listening, you should get out there and play as much Pete Dye golf as you can for any number of reasons. You know, first and foremost, to study architecture. Second of all, to learn more about the man, because Pete was just a great human being that had an absolutely fantastic, humble but sardonic sense of humor. He was particularly laconic, but he was universally loved, and his work was among the greatest. You know, when they do build the pantheon of great golf course architects, or perhaps a Mount Rushmore of the modern age, his face will have to be on the monument.
Most definitely. I would agree with that.
So you're also writing some fiction as well. You've got two different series going. You've got a fantasy series and a detective series. So tell us a little bit about each one of those.
Yeah, so the detective series is set in Indianapolis. It's kind of a throwback or an attempt at a throwback to something like a Raymond Chandler type of novel, where the detective's kind of a rough and gritty kind of guy and has had some bad luck and is just trying to establish himself and stay out of trouble, but stumbles upon a murder mystery or two. And so like the first book in the series, he is out for his daily run and stumbles across a body in the White River Canal and doesn't know who it is, tries to save the body and try to revive them, and realizes, oh, it's his friend that was buried 2 years ago. So all of a sudden it kicks off a mystery that he's trying to resolve. Number one, the murder and why the body was dug up. And then it kind of links back to a fraud scheme in a land fraud scheme in the local government. So, and then the second book in the series is actually goes out to Seattle to visit his ex-wife and son for the holidays and gets involved in a child abduction investigation with a local FBI office. And the third book in the series will probably be out next year at some point, as I'm kind of working on a, like you said, a fantasy series that actually the last book came out not too long ago. I just put out the cover for it a couple of months ago. And so it's more of a kind of the epic fantasy style book, kind of like a travel log, as they go around their little fantasy world, gathering forces to fight off the evil dictator. So it's kind of a traditional good versus evil story, where the two primary protagonists are a guy who's called a protector and has some special abilities, and his girlfriend, betrothed, whatever the term you want to call, they're not married at that time in the story, but she ends up finding out that she's got some special abilities and realizes that she's actually much more powerful than anybody else, and she's the secret to the whole thing. And so they end up taking down the big bad guys. And so it's kind of a throwback to like what you would think of like with those old Tolkien novels and some of his classic epic fantasy stories that
a little Terry Brooks, perhaps?
Maybe, yeah, a little bit of Terry Brooks, Terry Goodkind, kind of that kind of stuff, where you just, I think it's a fun read. And it started out as the inspiration for that was actually, so my son was struggling with trying to find something to read and was really struggling. And I was like, okay, well, what would you like to read? And he kind of told me and gave me an idea. And I'm like, okay, well, I'll try to write something like that. So that was like the first novella out of the series, which I wrote. Kind of, that was why I wrote it, was to try to get him to be interested in reading something. And so he liked it. And so I just kept building off of that story. And eventually it became a 4-part series that now is available in one big volume. So, and it's called The Forsaken Protector. So,
and your son is how old and what's his name?
So my son's name is Jason. He's 22. He's a college graduate now. So
how old was he when you started writing stories for him?
Let's see. He was, I want to say it was 5th or 6th grade, but it might have been junior high. So I'd have to look and see when it was actually done. But yeah, it might be junior high.
Well, hey, you know, J.R.R. Tolkien wrote Lord of the Rings as a monthly installment to his son who was fighting in World War II.
Huh. Yep.
So where can people order your books, and how can people find you on the internet and read more of your writings?
Yeah, so all my stuff's available through Amazon. I use Kindle Direct Publishing as my publishing venue. So it's all available in print or ebook, or you can reach out to me, and I have a site at clouserwritesbooks.wordpress.com.
So one last question out of curiosity. Who is on your nightstand right now? And who do you keep in the best section of your bookcase? You know, your very favorites.
Yeah. So the next book I'm going to read is actually, it's a third in a series by a guy named Luke Arnold, who's also an actor. He's got a fantasy detective series, and I'm getting ready to read the third book in that series. It's called One Foot in the Fade. So he kind of does a little play on words with the titles of the series. So, but people that have kind of a standing spot, I mean, Brandon Sanderson's always consistently good. I'm getting ready to read The Way of the Kings. I haven't read any of his Stormlight stuff yet. That's something I'm getting ready to read, I think. And then, and I know it's kind of a guilty pleasure. Sometimes I dive into a little bit of like, some mystery stuff, and like, V.E. Schwab's really good. Deanna Rayburn's got this series about a lady detective. It's kind of a fun read.
But hey, you're doing what successful writers do, which is you're making a broad sweep across the genre to pick up the very best of what everyone else will teach you from their writing. That's how you do it, everybody out there. Read, 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 then write, write, write.
Yeah. Yep. And I probably read more voraciously now than I did before I was a writer. And a lot of it's, like you said, trying to pick up on things. And I found a lot of things that I'm more interested in now than I was 10 years ago. So
I read the most voraciously when I lived in New York and took the subway for 45 minutes to work and back every day. I was able to knock back 2, maybe even 3 books a week like that. Wow.
Yeah, that's...
put a serious dent in a lot of literature. You know, you mentioned fantasy that has good plays on words. Are you familiar with Jasper Ford?
I am not, but I will definitely look that guy up. And
you want to. F-F-O-R-D-E. He is the next in a long and unbroken line of great British satirists that extends all the way back to Jonathan Swift.
Okay. Yeah, and I mean, I've read some like Douglas Adams, obviously, and some Terry Pratchett. So
I've read both of those. And if you like Douglas Adams, you will love this guy. He's very literary.
All right.
I will recommend The Fourth Bear, which is he blows up the story of Goldilocks and the Three Bears into an international mystery.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, anyway, you're listening to Jay Flemma's Sports Report. On our next segment, we're going to be talking about pop culture and sports outside of golf. We'll delve into a little hockey, and then we'll talk a little Foo Fighters. We will have the flag at half-mast for a while in all of our hearts for Taylor Hawkins of Foo Fighters. You a Foo Fighters fan, Chris?
I don't listen to a lot of music, so I'm more of a podcast kind of guy, so...
Well, you know, if you want to have a shot of tequila and grab your wife and have a dance, put Foo Fighters on. You'll have a lot of fun. All right. Jay Flemma Sports Report. We'll be right back after this. You're listening to iHeartRadio and Golf News Net Radio Network. All right. Welcome back to Jay Flemma Sports Report. I am Jay Flemma, and you're listening on iHeartRadio to the Golf News Net Radio Network. Welcome back, everybody, to this pre-PGA Championship edition. We want to thank Sports Illustrated and Morning Read for letting us have Gary Van Sickle talking about the Masters and the few events leading up to the PGA. And then also a big thank you to author Chris Clouser, who wrote the book on Perry Maxwell, the architect of Southern Hills, where the tournament will be this coming week. All right, changing gears over to the other sports, entertainment, and pop culture section of the show. The flag flies at half mast here at JFSR and Jay's Plays and JF.com and Golf News Net and all of our affiliates. in mourning for the music industry's great loss, the iconic drummer of Foo Fighters, the inimitable Taylor Hawkins, taken far, far too young from us at age 50. And here to talk a little bit about the impact of Foo Fighters and the legacy of both the band and Taylor Hawkins, please welcome one of the great American rock and roll drummers of the last generation. He's played in countless excellent bands, including Ominous Sea Pods, and now in Dr. Low and La Band. And he hosts an excellent music, pop culture, sports podcast called A Little Bit Famous with Ted Marotta. Here is the eponymously named gentleman himself, Ted Marotta. Please welcome him to Jay Flemma Sports Report.
Wow. What can I say? Jay, that was, can I get a copy of this? No. I'll put it on my CV.
Signing autographs at Barnes and Noble eventually.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for the lovely introduction and for having me on the show. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, we're glad to have one of the truly great drummers of our generation. Anybody who has not heard Ted's music, you instantly have to go to archive.org or YouTube and check out Ominous Sea Pods, either from the golden era from the early 90s to the early aughts, or now from the new era where the band's mostly reformed, sometimes rotating in other members. You'll really, really love to hear this guy play. But right now, first and foremost, we will never hear Taylor Hawkins play again. A great light has gone out. Tell us, you know, what do you foresee for Foo Fighters coming, and how huge an impact is this on the rock and roll community?
First of all, I mean, that's a great question, which I honestly hadn't thought about, which is what will the Foo Fighters be, whether they will be without Taylor Hawkins? My gut tells me they will continue. Obviously the band and, you know, Taylor's family and loved ones are mourning him right now. But you know, music is such a core part of all of those people's lives and hearts and passions and all of that. And I think my guess is Dave Grohl would probably want to continue in some way. And that would be, you know, I think ultimately that would be a good thing. I'm thinking of the Rolling Stones, you know, after Charlie Watts passing, not too long ago, deciding to continue to play. You know, it's one of those things I talk about with a lot of guests on my podcasts, who are creatives, which is, you know, most of them never had a plan B and certainly didn't try to figure out a plan B along the way while they were, you know, actively playing music. And it's not unique to music by any means, but people go all in and, you know, they just, this is my life. I love this more than anything, and this is what I'm going to do. So I'm hopeful that the Foo Fighters will continue. Although I don't know, you know, as far as the impact on the music industry, Taylor is a great drummer. You know, he was a great drummer. And when I've been thinking about this since you first invited me to appear on the segment, when you think about the possibilities or the chances of a drummer, first of all, landing a gig with Alanis Morissette, which was his first really high profile gig, right?
Yes.
You know, he had played with some other groups in the past and done a bunch of shows and all of that, but to get a call, like a tape in the mail, here, listen to these songs. We want you to play drums for this talented singer songwriter. And to do that for a while, and then to bump into Dave Grohl of all people and to ultimately get the gig playing in Dave Grohl's band. I don't know what a better, you know, indicator of Taylor's talent as a drummer to be asked to be Dave Grohl's drummer, and to really strike gold a couple times in his life, to have a successful year and a half with Alanis Morissette and then Alanis Morissette, and then find himself with the Foo Fighters. I'm sure we'll talk about it more, but the impact on the music industry, particularly the Foo Fighters and fans of the Foo Fighters for sure, is pretty significant. You know, the great drummers come along once in a while. Great drummers that really leave an imprint and make a mark and influence lots and lots of up and coming drummers, you know, along all the time.
If you were to list a fistful or more of drummers that would be in the great American pantheon of rock and roll drummers, where would Taylor be and who would be amongst?
Strictly American drummers.
It doesn't have to be American. Rock and roll drummers, Western Hemisphere, yeah, I guess.
Sure. Because I was like, oh, dang, there goes John Bonham.
Yes.
But of course, John Bonham would be very high on that list, in my opinion, of course. Bernard Purdy is another, Jeff Porcaro on the more modern side. I don't mean to just be serving this conversation. This is the truth. But I would put Dave Grohl on that list, and Nirvana, you know, his style, that's Dave Grohl's style. I think in many ways that might be what it comes down to, is that the drummer who has taken in years of either self-learning or being taught, listening to tons and tons of different kinds of music, manages to synthesize all of these influence into their own unique style, tend to be drummers that really kind of set the bar for drummers around the world. I would add Ringo Starr to that list, in terms of people who, when you put on a Beatle, you know, when you hear Ringo Starr playing, you're like, yes, it couldn't be anyone but Ringo. That is his thing. That's his fingerprint as a drummer. And I feel the same way about Dave Grohl. I mean, think about those iconic parts that Dave Grohl played on the Nirvana records, you know. And I think Taylor Hawkins would be very high on that list. You know,
it's a bit astonishing to hear the difference in musical creativity, indeed, in the songwriting from Nirvana on the one hand and the songwriting from Foo Fighters on the other. And I wonder if moving from emo, which it was the birth of emo and a pillar of emo, but moving from that to something that had cross appeal, both rock and roll and punk at the same time, was what really catapulted Foo Fighters into that upper echelon of crossover bands that everybody loves. Does that sound right?
Yeah, I would only add to that. I mean, I would add pop. And I mean pop music in the most loving sense, you know. People sometimes sort of use that as a knock.
They would say pop punk tending towards nerdcore, for example.
Yeah, or they would, you know, I mean, I love pop unironically. I say to myself, this is a beautifully constructed song with great guitar hooks or whatever other kind of melodies that are catchy, great lyrics. It's got a nice shine to it, and it's catchy and memorable. And so I consider pop to be a good thing. And obviously there's not so good pop out there, but Foo Fighters wrote, and maybe will continue to write, a lot of really great pop songs that are as rock and roll as can be. You know, they're thundering guitars and this, you know, incredible drums and very much in keeping with rock and roll. Like, they never slipped into what many artists do, which is, oh, let's make this like such a slick production. We'll use drum samples instead of a real acoustic drum set. We'll put some program parts in there and stuff like that. Foo Fighters are still 100% rock and roll.
And you'll get a kick out of the time I looked at Bowling for Soup and said, when I was an attorney, hey guys, you want me to get you a deal for some effects pedals? And they scornfully and disdainfully said, we don't use effects pedals.
Yeah, well, that's so pure.
It is. And that's one of the beautiful things in a way about Foo Fighters. Okay. When asked about what they're like, you know, when people who don't know rock and roll go, oh, you're in a rock band? What kind of music is it? He goes, we're very, very loud.
Yeah.
So but before we move on to the last segment of the show, tell us a little bit more about your podcast. And then after that, tell us a little bit about who are your influences as a drummer.
Sure. I'd love to. Well, last year and for quite some time before that, I'd been thinking about the idea of starting a podcast that would really be just conversations with creative people. And and what inspired it, in fact, and because we know each other a little bit and you know some of our history, was those 4 in the morning drunk band conversation / decompression, you know, kind of sessions where we would talk about the just absolute insanity of what we had just been a part of, or what kind of just how mundane the or awful it was, you know. And that tended to be the time when people would open up the most about what it's really like to be a creative and about what it's really like to go, well, just take a swan dive into kind of an alternate world and live that life. And so, yeah, so I've been doing the show for about a year and I've had some really great guests on. I've had some Grammy winning record producers like Steve Lillywhite and some couple of really good drummers, of course, like Steve Gorman.
Glenn Rosenstein too.
Great record producer, Glenn Rosenstein, and many others. And it's kind of a free, well, it is a free form conversation. I don't come with prepared questions or notes. We start talking, I listen attentively, and then we go on a little conversational journey. And it's great. Yeah, it's called A Little Bit Famous with Ted Marotta, which, by the way, is a self-deprecating joke. It's not the title is not a reference to my guests, who are far more famous and influential than I most of the time. But, you know, I have had little brushes with fame, and I'm using that word somewhat generously, but enough to get a sense of what it's like to have people drawn to you and want to watch you or listen to you and even want your autograph and all of that kind of stuff. So anyway, yeah, I love this. I love doing the show. I'm sure you as a fellow broadcaster, you know what I mean? It's just really fun to have good conversations with interesting people.
We're talking with Ted Marotta of the podcast, A Little Bit Famous with Ted Marotta. So last question, Ted, before we go to break, who are some of your influences as a drummer? Who did you listen to when you were younger? Who sort of became part of you in the work that you're doing?
I will take this in a couple of brief stages here. When I was very young, it was all pop music. I was just, whatever was on the radio was what I was listening to, and the records my parents had in their collection there. And that, so that included things, people like Paul Simon, or Simon and Garfunkel, which led me to some Steve Gadd playing drums. Steve Gadd was an influence. Basically every drummer from Steely Dan was an influence, and including Bernard Purdy, who I mentioned. And then at a certain point I got into classic rock, and that led me to Bonham. And then I just wanted to be John Bonham. I wanted to play like him with that strength, yet subtlety and finesse that Bonham really has that sometimes he doesn't get credit for. There were many others, including Aaron Comas from the Spin Doctors. He is a great drummer, just an absolutely great drummer. Ringo Starr. It's interesting because some drummers, and I had this arc too, listen to a lot of like very technically great drummers early on, like Neil Peart was also an influence early on. And you sort of learn Tom Sawyer and you learn subdivisions and you learn these fills and things. And then either you continue that down that path and become technically focused and start playing prog or something that demands that level of being able to play different time signatures, or you go the groovy way, which is what I did. You know, I started getting into Charlie Watts and Ringo Starr and a lot of great funk drummers. And that sort of became more my focus, was just trying to keep a good funky backbeat.
Any Chris Franz?
Oh, Chris, absolutely. Chris Franz is great. And again, he's one of those guys he's just basically a 4-on-the-floor kind of guy. He's not fancy schmancy, lots of fills, because the songs don't need it. You know, Jerry Harrison's over there got with this great rhythm guitar part. You know, there's some percussive keys going and some actual acoustic percussion happening too. And he's just right there in the middle, just keeping things.
And don't forget the goddess of rock, Tina Weymouth.
Amazing. Amazing. Such a great bass player, you know.
And such a great rhythm section between the two of them.
Absolutely. And it's so funny that you said that, because a tune like Once in a Lifetime, where her bass line it kind of defies science and is like an anti-groove in some ways, but it works so great in that for people who don't know, it's got that do-do-do-do. And that's what she does. That's basically what she does for the whole song. And it's fabulous. Yeah, they were a great rhythm section.
Anyway, thanks for coming on the show, Ted. We'll be looking very much forward to having you bring us updates throughout the year on what's happening in the rock music industry. Thanks for joining us on Jay Flum Sports Report.
Thank you so much, Jay. I was delighted to do this, and I look forward to talking to you soon.